Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast. My name is Willie Simpson.
My name is Sonya Rappaport.
And today, Sonya, we are talking about the fourth episode of Season 4, the 51st episode overall, Proteus, Part 1.
Yes.
Are you excited?
I'm excited. I like that you gesticulate wildly with, like, one finger pointed in the air every single episode that we do while you, when you're reading the numbers that go along with it.
Well, I wouldn't be able to keep track of all these episodes in a row if my fingers weren't wildly gesticulating. It's part of my mutant power.
I see.
Yeah. So this episode is, it's a kind of another ripped from the comics episode. In really the best way, it's a two-parter, so we're only going to talk about part one today. And this episode, it's actually a really good episode.
Yeah, it's super cool.
Yeah, it's very well done. I like the team, the X-team that's assembled for it. You know, as we've noticed, it's not like they've really just done away with having the full roster in most episodes.
It's too much.
Yeah. So I think you're really only going to see the full roster in special, like, full-blown episodes. But in this one, you're only going to get Rogue, Beast, Wolverine, and Professor X, and a guest appearance by Banshee. But this episode has everything I love about this show.
Oh, yeah?
It's got backstories, a retelling of a comic book, a classic comic, but in a nice, like, summarized, made-for-television way.
Mm-hmm.
It's got, like, direct animated references to drawn panels from the comics,
mm-hmm.
which is always cool to see. It's a little bit of wish fulfillment fantasies for comic book fans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like a nice, well-written tale that is like very like in the theme of the X-Men in terms of, you know, what it's like to grow up a mutant, the dangers of being a mutant, you know, the dangers of mutants that are out there, and, you know, all that kind of wonderful stuff. So we're going to talk about it all.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm very excited to talk about this one.
Let's get talking.
All right, let's get talking. So it actually opens with a like sly, subtle reference to the previous episode, where our old pal Morph sort of rejoins the team, and he ends up killing Master Mold, which is pretty badass of him, mm-hmm. getting full revenge on the Sentinels after they killed him.
Yeah.
But at the end...
But then he's like, I'm not ready for this life. I gotta go back into, like, rehabilitation for a little while.
Yeah. So we see, like, a very quick glimpse of him back at Muir Island in Scotland. He's, like, strapped to a gurney somewhere, getting some more treatment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't really tell it's him.
I'm pretty sure it's him.
It has to be him.
The costume looks like his costume.
Yeah, I mean, it's the generic X-Men costume. Like, there's this standard X-Men costume that I like and it's kind of underappreciated. It's the blue pants with the yellow over underpants and the yellow, like, bifurcated chest thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, like, the standard outfit. And they all kind of wear variations of it, if you mm-hmm. think about it. Like, Cyclops essentially has a standard outfit, but instead of the broad yellow stripe down the middle, he's got, like, the yellow belt buckle thing with the X logo.
The sash.
Right. I mean, Rogue, yeah. Yeah, his, like, weird belt sash.
Yeah.
Rogue essentially has the outfit, too, but the color scheme's different, because mm-hmm. hers
is green instead of blue.
Right, yeah. I mean, Wolverine essentially has the team colors with the yellow and blue,
mm-hmm.
but it's inverted and it's got a little bit of his personal style. So, I mean, it's an outfit we see, like, various, like, versions of.
Yeah.
And I remember, I think this outfit was kind of debuted in the 80s. It was, like, an update on the classic
yellow and blue.
Yeah, the classic X-Men
blue and gold,
uniform.
Whatever,
right.
Yeah.
It was, like, a little more sleek and modern. Like, Gambit had it at one point in the 80s. Mm. It's just, like, Kitty Pryde had it at some point. I might be wrong there, but I just remember Gambit specifically had it.
Yeah, but, like, it's definitely, I think it's definitely Morph. Coming from the last episode, they show us in the opening of this episode it's Muir Island, and we know that Morph had been there for, like, mutant rehab or whatever before.
Yeah, so it's
psychological
Morph.
Rehab, and, like, yeah,
so
it's Morph.
It's a nice little callback, and this episode will feature some other nice callbacks. And then this Muir Island Mutant Research Center that Moira MacTaggert runs, boy, that's a mouthful.
Oof, yeah.
It's, like, quite the facility. She's really got a lot of, like, futuristic stuff going on. So, you know, I guess she's one of these, like, magical scientist people in the Marvel Universe. You've got your Tony Stark
mm-hmm.
with his labs, your Reed Richards of the Fantastic Four, your Shuri's from Black Panther.
Yeah.
You know, there's, like, quite a few, like, scientists with some incredible, like, wave more futuristic laboratory space than
fan
like,
service
real world.
To all the nerds out there reading the comics.
Well, I mean, that's just like one of the like tropes of like comics in general is that science is always slightly a bit ahead of what the real world is.
Mm-hmm.
It's more sci-fi.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing like way more like cutting edge, like borderline dangerous experiments in science of comics than they are in real life.
But Moira never really achieves like superhero status, right?
Well, I mean, she's not a superhero, but she works in the field of mutant studies, so yeah. She's dealing with superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually seems like the town she operates out of, or Muir Island, has a lot of mutants on it, as
right.
We'll see again.
I wonder if she chose to put her facility there because of that, or if her facility attracted all of the mutants.
I gotta think that her facility attracted the mutants. I don't think that there's a natural, like, a large amount of mutants at Muir Island in northern Scotland or somewhere. I think it's, like, one of those weird, you know, it's like it's a place that it drew that population because of the research center.
Right. I guess the only reason I was wondering about her elevating to, like, mutant status is, like, Tony Stark, you know, invents stuff to become Iron Man and, like,
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, he's got a whole company, Stark
right,
Industries.
Right, but he's, yeah, I know.
It's always like
but it seems like she could like have an experiment gone wrong or something.
Well, I mean, in a lot of ways she does. I mean, like there's a ton of Moira MacTaggert storylines in the comics.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the more famous ones, at least the ones that I remember. So it turns out she's got a secret son named Kevin.
Just gave away the ending.
No, not really, because
they tell you in the beginning that he's
yeah, I think
son?
So.
Oh, okay, I forgot.
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, so
not that we're like ones to avoid spoilers.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, the spoilers for a 30-year-old cartoon. So she's giving her son Kevin some treatments. It turns out he's 17. He's just a normal Scottish boy. She's there with her boyfriend or fiance Banshee, who we saw in the Phoenix Saga, and he's not in like his work and his like street clothes. He's in his full Banshee outfit, the green and yellow, you know, deal.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always love Banshee's look because I love his wings.
Mm.
I thought that was a really cool, unique design for that character. His wings are, like, they're attached under his, like, forearms and connected to his sides. And they've got that cool, like, bumblebee pattern to them.
Mm-hmm. But it looks like the material is spandex or something.
Yeah.
It's more like a bat wing design or something. Isn't that the same design that the real-life guy used when he jumped...
You mean in the movie?
From outer space. No, oh. Not in the movies, like in real life.
That guy that jumped out of that spaceship
yeah.
and, like, did a free fall.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe. It seems like it's the kind of outfit they actually use for those people that do that free fall flying type stunts you
yeah,
see.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Something similar to that, yeah. So maybe it's, like, slightly in real world practicality, but I doubt those suits existed when Banshee was created in the late 60s.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if like Banshee inspired all those people.
I think it's probably just more of a coincidence.
Or I guess, yeah. It's just common sense that it would work. They're all modeled off of like bats and like actual animals that can fly. So.
Right, yeah. If someone knows, let us know. So her son, Proteus, is getting these really bizarre treatments. Moira refers to it as sonic therapy. They're blasting a bunch of weird like laser beams at him, I guess. And he's this big like orange monster. He's quite terrifying. And he's got, like, insanely bizarre powers. He's, like, a creature of, like, pure energy or something. Although he's got, like, a boy body under there. But essentially what he does is, like, he needs to inhabit other beings to, like, get around.
Well, because he looks so unsettling, I don't think he actually needs anything from those other beings. It's just that he's so conspicuous when he's not inhabiting a person.
Well, you know, you might be right for the cartoon, definitely. I don't think... They remove this element. In the comics, he's like a vampire.
Oh,
he needs to feed off other living beings to survive. And it's... And anyone... If he takes over your body, you're dead instantly in the comics. He's, like, way more terrifying and murderous.
Wow, that's a whole new perspective.
Yeah, he's, like, they really spin him into a more sympathetic character in this. In the comics, he is not sympathetic. He is just straight-up evil and, like, tortured.
I kind of like that, though, from the comics, as opposed to this, like, clean-washed version.
Yeah.
Just because it makes the character a lot more complex. And it seems like a lot of times when there's a mutant or a superhero who has a really great power, there's, like, an equal and opposite downside to it in their personal life
right.
or some other way.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, this guy, in the comics, he had a lot of downside because he needed to possess other humans. Right. And the thing is, like, he can only be in the human for so long, he literally drains their energy to where they become, like, these rotting, like, corpse shells.
Wow.
And they sort of, like, the skin, like, sort of almost melts off the body in a disgusting way, and they turn, like, black ashen colored.
Mm.
So he has to quickly find, like, a new host.
I see why they didn't do that in the
cartoon. Yeah, the cartoon, they can't go there. Yeah, and the thing is, like, in the, like I said, in the comic, the second he takes over a body, that body's dead. It's not, there's no coming back, even if he left right away.
Hmm.
I'm pretty sure. I don't think, like, maybe Proteus could have revived the body if he wanted to, but I don't, that wasn't in the cards in the comic, and it also just seemed like they're dead. So it's like, it was really dangerous for the X-Men to face him, because if he took over one of their bodies, they were screwed.
Gotcha. And how did the body takeover happen? Did they have to be touching, or could he just, like, jump in?
I don't really remember in the comic. I'm assuming he had to just, like, he had to jump somebody. It was probably actually similar to the cartoon. He probably just, like, flowed into the body.
Hmm.
You know, used his energy form to, like, jump into it somehow.
Wow.
But a lot of the other details from the comics are similar in that he is the son of a famous politician, this Joe McTaggart, who Moira had an affair with at one point, her ex-husband or something, or ex-lover.
Yeah.
And he's searching for his father, and Moira's, you know, trying to stop him.
Did you notice that Moira kept calling him Yo instead of Joe?
Really? No, yeah. I didn't notice that. Is that just her accent?
Is that part of her accent?
She wasn't calling him Yo.
She did.
Joe.
She did, twice.
Well, if that's the case, it had to be her accent then. Yeah. I didn't notice that at all. That's crazy. All
right.
But I think in the comic, more spoilers, he finds his father, like, pretty quickly, and he takes over his body, and the father's instantly dead, and it's really, like, messed up. Yeah, it's like, and he's, like, really malevolent when he's in his father, too. It's not like he's out looking for, I don't think he's out looking for the love of his father so much. I think he more wants revenge.
Mm.
I'm not quite sure. But
Sounds like he gets it.
Yeah, but in the cartoon, let's go back to the cartoon. Like,
yeah.
Moira has him locked up in the cell with a big placard called Mutant X, you know, with laser beams, you know, like a holographic laser beam prison for him. And it's weird that she has, like, the placard that says, this is Mutant X, like, beware.
Yeah.
But then she also, like, gave her son, who's named Kevin, another name of Proteus. Like, she also gave him a mutant code name, which is kind of bizarre.
Right.
And it doesn't seem like Kevin gave himself that name, because Kevin's kind of simple, because he's had to grow up in the mutant center and, like, locked away.
Mm-hmm.
He more comments that he's immature and doesn't know about the world.
Well, it's not that he's simple. It's not like his brain development is behind.
No, I meant simple,
like that,
just in the sense of just being totally unexposed to the real world.
Mm, gotcha.
Which doesn't make sense, because he seems to be, like you said, of normal intelligence. Why not, like, give him a TV and some books or something?
Right.
Like, why does he
give
have to be...
something to do, at least.
Yeah, like, why does he have to be cut off from the world? You can teach him about life. It's like, gives the impression you get is when he goes out into the world, he's like, Mother, you never told me about all these things to do and feelings and things to experience and, like, people. I don't even understand what fathers are, you know?
Yeah, it makes her seem kind of cruel, which is weird because she's Professor X's ex. And,
well, she's, like, a good guy.
Right, exactly. We've seen her so many times and assume so many good things about her.
Well, I mean, this is why this episode and the storyline is really cool, is because his powers are so insanely dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So we've only talked about a little bit of his powers, that, like, he can inhabit other bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And when he does, they have this, like, really, like, insane green glowing eyeballs. And that, you know, like, that's another question I had. It's like,
dead giveaway.
Yeah, exactly. Like, do other characters notice that your eyeballs are glowing nuclear green?
Or is it just for the benefit of the audience?
Right,
watching?
Yeah, exactly. So I wonder if he's, like, sneaking around and they're not noticing because that happens later with Rogue.
Yeah.
It's like it's Proteus reaching out to Professor X, and she's like, hey, don't touch him. And she doesn't realize this guy's got glowing green eyeballs.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Seems like it's more for us to know than for anything else.
I guess that's something you would notice from any human being.
Yeah.
So, but I don't know. It's kind of ambiguous. But anyway, his other powers, he's a telepath.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got the power to warp reality, which is essentially the power of God. What else is that power? I mean, you know, like, it's a facet, it's a godlike power.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, actually, Professor X has a godlike power, right? Telepathy is godlike.
I mean, a lot of the powers are, but actually, like, in the Facebook group, when one of the group members asked, like, put out the question to everybody.
Bryce
had asked, what's, like, your dream mutant power? And that, like, this is essentially the manifestation of my dream power, which was to just, like, control all the matter of the universe.
That's insane. Like, that's your power?
Yeah, like, shape-shifting, except not just you.
Oh, my God.
But, like, everything around you
that's
also.
That's way too scary. I would not want to have that power. Because as you can see here, look how hard it is to control and how dangerous it is.
Well, but he has the inevitable downside, which is that he has to be a scary orange monster that gets locked up and inhabit people. That's not part of what I imagined.
You know, it's like, what's the difference between, like, Proteus's power to completely manipulate reality and Jean Grey's power of telekinesis?
She moves things. He changes things.
But she could, like, theoretically, if her power was, like, like souped up, which we see it get with the Phoenix Force. Like, well, the Phoenix essentially has this power, too.
Uh-huh.
But it's like, if you are a really strong telekinetic, you could, like, lift the ground up in, like, a wave like Proteus does. He literally, like, raises his arm and the grass forms, like an ocean wave that he rides on.
Right. Oh, and then when he's gone, it's, like, his, well, that whatever snaps, he changed goes back.
As a telekinetic, it wouldn't snap back because you've changed it. You know what I mean? Like, you're moving stuff, like you said.
Right.
But isn't the principle the same that, like, you could, if you were strong enough, you could warp, like, buildings and stuff?
But he also just, like, there's a part where he, like, puts four rocks up in the air around Rogue and then makes the rocks change into mini Rogues.
Yeah.
Right? That's crazy.
Yeah, so that's not Jean quite, Grey, like, it's like telekinetic, a, yeah.
If she were, like, super-powered, like, plugged into some infinite energy source, do you think that would be part of her powers?
Well, I mean, it would be if she was Phoenix. Phoenix could do it, but you're right, as just a normal telekinetic, I don't think so, because she's still working in the realm of the laws of physics as a telekinetic. She's lifting things like Magneto,
right?
Except they don't have to be metal.
Right.
So, yeah, I guess not. Like, if she couldn't take a skyscraper and bend it, like, twist it in, like, a candy cane.
We haven't seen her do that.
Well, she couldn't, because it would break in two because of the laws of physics.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, right? Like, it wouldn't, like, he can, like, actually change the laws of physics and twist things in ways they shouldn't be twisted into, like, weird tetrahedrons and other weird geometric shapes and patterns.
Right.
So, and it's actually, his power is even, like, much greater than that, as we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, like, a really terrifying power, and it is really scary in the comics, too, because his power is, like, almost unlimited.
Yeah.
And to have that ability is crazy. And so, at least all these questions is, like, is Senator Kelly correct? Do we need the Mutant Registration Act at the least? You know, do we need gigantic robot sentinels to control these mutants? If you've got one that can...
Doesn't seem like the sentinels would be able to do anything to this guy.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like, and also, like...
Well, I mean, you know, he is stopped by the X-Men and stopped, like, in this cartoon at some point, too. Spoilers, we haven't got to part two yet. But
also, I think the root of his personality is not evil. In the cartoon anyway. It sounds like it's different in the comics.
Yeah, the comics is pretty
but,
bad.
But, like, it speaks to, like, you know, Professor X's optimism is all centered around that, like, mutants and humans alike, like, everyone has a good core to them.
And they need a school to go to so he can educate them to use their powers and not be shitty people.
Right, and so it's like we find out over the course of this storyline that Proteus doesn't have any kind of, like, ill intent towards humanity or the world or anything. He's just, like,
misunderstood,
a confused, like, adolescent, you know, undereducated and, like, needs some answers.
Yeah, that's true. So, but still, he's so dangerous that it, I don't know, I would be terrified if such an individual was loose.
Right.
I wouldn't know what to think. Like, even if I was, you know, as liberal as I am in reality about, you know, not oppressing people.
Yeah.
But this is different. I mean, this is, like, actual monsters.
Well, that's exactly what comes to pass, is that he goes out wandering the streets and everybody's terrified of him.
It's a really great scene. But actually, I was thinking the Sentinels could stop him. Because his one weakness in the comics, anyway, I don't remember in the cartoon, we haven't got to part two yet, is metal.
Oh.
In the comics, they beat him. Colossus turns into metal, and he punches him in his energy form, and that, like, completely disperses and kills him.
Oh, okay.
Well, kills him in quotes. Like, I think it, like, comes back years later in some clone or some other weird, like, he's revived somehow, or they try to revive him. But he's essentially killed by Colossus. So, like, metal is his primary weakness.
Interesting.
Yeah. We'll see in part two if that's the case here. I forget. But
Yeah, there's so that element of suspense.
So the Sentinels, if they're made of metal, maybe they could like jump him. You know, like he'd probably be able to take out like 100 of them like right away. But they're all flying at him. They just have to punch him once. Mm. So anyway, it's like I mean, Proteus's existence raises a really terrifying question. It's also in the world of, it reminds me of Legion a bit. So Legion, you know, the FX series based on the comic book, he's the son of Professor X. Not the son of Professor X and Moira. It's some other woman. But, and Proteus isn't the son of Professor X, he's the son of Moira. But it's like in that ballpark of like the weird children of Professor X that are like ultra powered. And actually in the Ultimate line of Marvel Comics, Proteus and Legion are combined as one character. So there's like some overlap because it's just like it's a similar story in a lot of ways, like mentally tortured, like children in the Professor X orbit family, you know, like that are way overpowered.
Yeah.
And Legion's got kind of similar power. Like he's a telepath like Professor X, but his telepathy is like way off the charts. And he's got telekinesis too, I think. And
but he also
telekinesis. Right?
But in Legion, also he inhabits a world that like hasn't fully accepted mutantism, so they try to convince him that he doesn't really have these powers. And
well, the whole thing. Legion could be called Mindfuck, the show. You know, you know, you don't really. And it's interesting in Legion because you don't really even know what time frame it is because everyone's like in weird mod 60s clothes.
Right. But then there's a lot of futurism.
There's like cell phones,
stuff happening too. Yeah.
Yeah. So Legion's a very strange show. And season 2 is coming back like this month, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So we got to get back on that and talk about it a little bit. Because as we've mentioned before, that's the inspiration for this podcast.
Yeah, I really like that show.
Yeah, we were watching Legion last year and we're like, I want to talk about the X-Men. But, you know,
I have to say, though, the villain from season 1 really creeped me out.
The whole show creeped me out.
It was really successfully
It was a Shadow
creepy.
King.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Really creepy.
I'm excited, though, because Patrick Stewart did say that he would return as Professor X if Legion asked. I don't think they're going to do that, though.
No.
I mean,
I don't know if FX has a budget like that.
Well, it's not even. I don't think it'd be a question of budget for a cameo from Patrick Stewart.
Oh,
I think.
A cameo. Yeah, I thought you were talking about like a role.
No, yeah, he wouldn't be the star. He'd be like one. He would either appear like for 30 seconds in one scene at the end of the of a season. You know, it's like it's like Legion. I'm your father. You know, or just as like in a dream almost too. It'd be like a joke scene.
Oh,
kind
I see.
Of thing. You know what I mean? Like I bet they
I
would
mean,
do
they
that.
Could write him a whole role. Yeah. Like I said, I don't think they have the budget for it, but, like, flashbacks and stuff,
they
know?
Couldn't... I don't think they could really have Patrick Stewart as Professor X because, like you said, it would be too distracting. All of a sudden, you'd want to know more about Professor X. Like, he would overshadow the rest of the show.
Yeah, that's true.
He would have to be a regular cast member, and then the show would be called Professor X and Legion.
Yeah.
And his son, Legion, you know? Because you want to see Patrick Stewart, and you want to see Professor X, and you want to think about the X-Men. You don't, you know?
So I don't know. I want to see Legion and his girlfriend. Their storylines are interesting.
Absolutely, but I'm saying, but the second you introduce the character, forget about Patrick Stewart, the character of Professor X.
Yeah.
It's too distracting. It's like, then all of a sudden, the show becomes about Professor X.
Yeah,
you know?
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
So, if anything, like, if they would ever even have Patrick Stewart, it would be like, it's like a 20-second joke cameo, like, Legion's having a dream, and Professor X, like, appears in it, and it's like he's wearing a clown suit, you know, or something, and makes a joke. And then he wakes up, he's like, oh, that was weird. You know, it'd be like that.
Yeah.
It'd be like a weird, like, fan service, like, trickery thing.
Hmm. Well, maybe.
Anyway, but, like, so the Proteus plotline, the Legion plotline, there's a lot of, like, similarities. This is my only point about that.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So, but this episode's really cool. Like, Professor X gets the, Proteus escapes. He escapes the facility. He's really dangerous. And Moira sends out the bat signal to Professor X in New York. And Professor X assembles his team of, like we said, Rogue, Beast, and Wolverine. They hop in the Blackbird, fly the Atlantic. They go to Muir Island a lot. Makes you wonder how fast the Blackbird can traverse the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a supersonic jet.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how much faster it goes past the speed of sound, but it's probably like, I'd say it's probably, because they've got such futuristic technology, 2 hours.
How fast did the Concorde fly from Paris to New York?
I should have looked it up.
It was like an hour or something, wasn't
it? Is it? Like, really? It's like an hour?
Okay. I don't know. I might be making that up.
All right, you look it up. I'll keep babbling here. So we get, like, some great, like, Professor X is now flashing back to his life. And we've seen a lot of Professor X flashbacks on this show. We've seen him, his flashbacks with Magneto as like a doctor with him after a war in Eastern Europe. We see him as a young boy growing up with Juggernaut.
Oh, I was way off.
What, how fast is it?
Transatlantic flights are 3.5 hours on the Concorde.
Okay, so that's on the Concorde. So on the Blackbird, which is probably faster than the Concorde.
Yeah.
It's probably like an hour, maybe.
All right.
Well, who knows?
Let's speculate wildly. Why not?
Sorry. I'm sure there's an answer to that, too. I bet that was, like, revealed in some X-Men cartoon, how faster the X-Jet goes with the Blackbird.
Let me Google that and see.
So, this is another different Professor X flashback. It shows him, like, actually in the army. And I don't know if we're, like, supposed to believe it's Vietnam or Korea. In the comics, I'm pretty sure Professor X is a Korean War vet. At least Juggernaut was. And actually, in this cartoon, they suddenly intimate that Professor X got paralyzed because of his fighting in the war, which I don't think is... It's definitely not the case in the comics. That's not how he got paralyzed. I think an alien named Lucifer paralyzed him. And it's not the case in the movies. But just some interesting shading. Like, that I think he was, like, a war veteran, and which is kind of bizarre to think about Professor X being in, a war. But before the war, he proposes to Moira MacTaggert. They were in love. But she sends him a Dear John letter, and it breaks his heart. She mails back the ring and says she's met somebody. He doesn't know she's pregnant.
I felt like I was watching a soap opera when I saw this part.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. I was like, Moira.
You were really upset
Even
at
though,
her.
Like, I knew that, whatever. Anyway, go
Well,
ahead.
She got seduced when he was away. It happened to many a soldier in battle, you know? It's a tale as old as time. So he's having that flashback, and then we actually see like some more incredible flashback. Like, this is a great scene. They show Professor X then launches his mission with the X-Men. He falls in love with another woman. I'm not sure who this other woman is. She probably is someone from the comics. I just can't remember who. In this cartoon, they definitely don't say who it is. Mm-hmm. But it's like this redhead that kind of looks like Jean Grey. Maybe it was his nurse that was taking care of him after he got paralyzed. Mm-hmm. They show that scene.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's training the original X-Men. They're all in their original 1963, 1964 X-Men outfits, as we were talking about. The blue and gold. Cyclops, Beast, Iceman. Beast, the pre-Blue Beast. The human Beast, we see. We also see in the shows, like, one of the major continuity errors, we see Angel as an early X-Men member.
Mm-hmm.
And he's wearing the weird, like, red, green, and yellow outfit we saw Morph change into just an episode ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's, like, it's, like, a weird, like, late 60s outfit that I think Angel had in the comics. But anyway, Angel should not be on the original X-Men team because they meet Warren Worthington III later on and, you know, he's different. He's retcon for the cartoon. So the fact that he's a part of the original X-Men is confusing. It doesn't make sense. But whatever. It's fine. It's not like, I don't think anyone's upset by seeing it. In fact, it makes it more interesting in my point of view.
Hmm.
The Angel backstory. And then, the other weird thing, Jean Grey is with them, obviously.
Yeah.
But she, unlike the other X-Men, she's not wearing her Marvel Girl outfit.
Right. She's in her, like, modern outfit.
The beige one, which makes no sense. Especially when you're looking back at the Dark Phoenix saga, in the last episode there, when they're fighting on the moon to save her life, she decides to wear her Marvel Girl outfit, which, granted, is not the original X-Men outfit. It's like her lime green dress that she wore, her go-go dress with the yellow mask.
Yeah, but it's a nod to the past.
Right, so it's like, it would have made more sense if she was wearing that in this flashback. But she's not even wearing that. She's wearing her beige outfit.
Well, I mean, how much does it really bother you? It's like a little, like, scene thrown in that's supposed to be for fan service, and they got some of the details wrong. Like, do you feel they shouldn't put in scenes if they're not going to do it right?
I think it absolutely doesn't bother me. In fact, it adds to the charm of the show.
Okay.
It's like...
Because I didn't really care.
No,
noticed it, and I was like, oh, ha.
Absolutely, but that's what's fun about it. It's the fun, especially in the early 90s, you're watching it as a kid.
Yeah.
You would pick up on that stuff, and if anything, it would fire your imagination more because you might know what the real outfit is. Or you're like, wait, why is Angel on the X-Men? You know, as a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
You're trying to contemplate these things. So if anyway, it like makes it more interesting, like that you were able to, you had that early like sense of superiority as a comic book nerd.
Mm-hmm.
You got that first taste of it. You know, and this is like from a more simple time, pre-internet, sort of, for the most part, you know, and pre, like, just all information at our fingertips.
Yeah.
So, you know, stuff like that would actually, it would, it would create like a very smug sense of self-satisfaction if you knew like something was amiss. So, I think those days are long gone. It's just like, because everyone can look up anything, we just take information for granted, and just like having an encyclopedia in your brain is no longer a feat onto itself so much anymore. You know, it just makes you annoying, I think, more than anything.
Yeah. I'm going to interject here with some Blackbird trivia, the best that I can glean from the internet right now.
Okay, what's it say?
So, in real life, in 1964, the SR-71 plane was invented, and it's nicknamed the Blackbird.
Right, that's kind of what the X-Jet was based off of, right?
Right, exactly.
We saw that at the Washington Aviation Museum.
Exactly, so, like, this SR-71 is a real plane. It does do that, like, vertical takeoff.
Oh, sweet.
In real life. And it also goes 3 times the speed of sound, which means that when they were bringing it to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, they flew it from Los Angeles to Washington in 67 minutes.
Wow.
Which is normally a 6-hour flight, right?
How can these...
Which means that, like, New York to Paris is normally an 8-hour flight, right. Which stands to reason it would be, like, a little over 80 minutes, like 90 minutes.
So, like, my question to you, aviation expert Sonia, is why isn't this technology broadly adapted for commercial flying? Is it because the jet fuel is too expensive? Or the planes themselves are too expensive. It's not practical. They can't hold much like passengers or cargo.
My guess.
Or the planes cost like $2 billion each, and you know.
Yeah, my guess would be just the cost of the plane itself,
the engines and everything. Yeah, probably it also has to do with the fuel too. They probably.
Actually, the way that they phrase it is that the Blackbird was designed to cruise in afterburner at 3 times the speed of sound for hours on end.
Wow.
Yeah. So afterburn makes me feel like it's serious jet fuel, which is really, or, you know, rocket fuel, which is like really expensive.
Well, one day when we get off like gasoline powered engines for planes, it'll be really interesting what kind of technology they can come up with, you know?
Yeah.
When they're not relying on fossil fuels to power engines.
Yep.
Then maybe we could have these supersonic jet flights across. You know, I know Elon Musk wanted to have some sort of rocket ship commuting thing, right?
Right.
Where he would blast a rocket into the atmosphere and then it would land. Like, you can go from New York to Tokyo in, like, 12 minutes or something.
Right, yeah.
I don't know how practical that is, but he was talking about it.
Yeah.
So, pretty cool. Back to this episode. So, Proteus is sort of, like, rampaging around Scotland. He's trying to get to Edinburgh to find his father. He's warping reality, twisting buildings into weird pretzel-like shapes, which is really disorienting, you know, twisting the streets up and causing, like, mass panic and terror in the street. There's actually a really, like, nice scene after he's left, because after he leaves an area, reality snaps back to normal, and the people of Scotland are just stunned, like, kind of quietly afraid. And that was actually, I thought that was really cool, you know, like, a realistic crowd scene of terror.
Yeah.
And I really like scenes of crowd terror and reaction shots, especially in like a big like urban area,
because
I feel like movies and TV shows don't do it that well all the time.
That's a much criticized aspect of a lot of the superhero movies recently. Superman and Batman, but it's mostly because like it's all CGI'd, right?
Yeah.
And if they're gonna put in all those extra people, they want them to look like real people, so it's a matter of getting like a billion extras. Or, like, trying to CGI all these people in that aren't going to look like real people. Know what I mean? Like, the cost would be astronomical to, like, make that happen.
Well, I don't know how astronomical the cost would be to have a bunch of extras. Well, you don't have to render them.
People, yeah.
Well, okay, so let me give you some examples. Two of the best movies that had crowd reactions. One, Superman, the original. When Superman's flying around Metropolis in the 1978 film, there's tons of awesome crowd reaction shots. And lots of like wide shots of like large crowds in awe of Superman, you know?
Right, that's true.
And they really capture the feel of the city. It was filmed in New York City. Metropolis was a stand-in. New York was a stand-in for Metropolis.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all these just scenes of like cars crashing into each other and like just people pointing and laughing, and it's great, you know? Like I think that was perfect in the way that, and to me that's like the fun of a superhero movie is seeing the crowd react. And then so the other movie.
Have you ever been to the Daily Planet building?
No, but I've been outside Clark Kent's fictional apartment building that's in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay. The Daily Planet building is on, like, 3rd Avenue and 42nd Street.
What building is in real life? I probably have been there.
I don't know the name of it, but, like, they have, like, the big, like, Daily Planet, like, globe statue thing in the lobby. Right, but
it doesn't say
lobby.
Daily Planet on it. Oh, it's in the lobby?
Yeah, it's cool.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I don't know. And then Clark Kent's apartments in Brooklyn Heights.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Huh. It's just, like, he supposedly lived in... Well, he lived in Metropolis, but he lived on a street based off of Brooklyn Heights, which is kind of cool.
Huh.
But anyway, so the other movie where crowd shots are the absolute best, Ghostbusters.
Mm, yeah,
when the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man is marching through Midtown there.
And the Statue of Liberty, like, that parade.
Yeah, but more so in the first one.
Uh-huh.
It's perfect. There's literally hundreds of people in the shot running in terror. It's like a Godzilla movie.
Yeah.
And it's just... And there's cameramen pointing at the thing. The tone is so perfect, and it's just, like, that's what I need to see in a movie.
So you think the Superman-Batman movies, it's not a practical thing about rendering or extras? You think it's the tone that they're trying to set? Like, it's eerie? They have this, like, eerie, Batman's otherworldly, different. Like, you know,
well, super,
the music
like
plays.
I said, the Superman was one was fine. The original Superman was good.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, the modern Superman
movies. Oh, yeah, those were awful. Yeah. Well, I think Marvel has the same problem. Mm-hmm. I think... When Iron Man's flying around, and when even the X-Men, you know, like, whoever Marvel movie it is, there's not... You know, the best example is Avengers, the first one, in their New York City having the Battle of New York. There's a few scenes with, like, you see people, but it's not the stampeding terror that it should be. Like, it should have been a riot.
I guess the other thing is
of
that
madness.
They don't like showing people dying in those movies. And it stands to reason that if there's lots of people around, and then they do all their special effects to make the buildings collapse into each other, and explosions, and energy beams, and all that stuff, that people are going to be dying left and right.
But see, that's the fun. You mentioned that, like, that's the funny thing about Man of Steel, the Superman movie, Zack Snyder, is that all these buildings are collapsing, but they don't show any of the people, really. But in the Marvel movies, it's like a similar level of destruction. But they, like, always are indicating that people are safe.
Right.
Which is weird. Doesn't make sense. And then the biggest joke of all was in Captain America Civil War. They have, like, this quick graphic of all the disasters they've been involved in, their adventures, and they show the fatalities.
Yeah.
They show, like, two stats on each disaster.
I feel like that was direct response to people criticizing the fact that there's no people.
Well, but I don't know if that was a direct response, but I just think the joke was that they showed, like, for the Battle of New York and Avengers, they showed this quick graphic, and you had to pause the screen to read it. It's like, it caused $50 billion in damage. Okay, like, that's...
Fine, whatever.
That's right. But then it's like, only, like, 78 people died. Uh-huh. It's like, give me a break, you know? Like,
you mean, right.
You mean, like, 30,000 people died, and that's, like, on the small end. New York's a city of 8.5 million. Like, 30,000 would be a relatively low number, in my opinion, if there's an alien invasion with laser beams exploding all the buildings.
Right.
And giant slugs, like, flying through the skyscrapers.
Yeah.
So it's, like, only, like, 100 people died? Like, no way. It's so dumb.
Yeah.
And, like I said, I think these movies don't do a good job of showing, like, the crowd panic and the realistic crowd and city streets. That's what I want to see in one of these superhero movies, and I think that would blow people's minds.
Well, that's exactly what you got in this episode.
So yeah, exactly. Yeah.
How about that?
Well, in a cartoon, it's easier to do in a cartoon.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that's not even true, too, because a lot of cartoons, especially superhero cartoons, I noticed there's a lot of fighting on barren streets.
Mm-hmm.
And the X-Men's guilty of that, too, but they do show good crowd reactions a lot in the show.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, to me, that's, like, so much part of the world of comics is that you have a terrified normal populace is, like, an element of the whole point.
Right, because it makes it more based in reality. It makes you believe it.
Right, yeah. So, movies, Marvel movies, start casting. I know it's difficult, but get hundreds, if not thousands, of extras and wide shots and show them all running, panicking, running out of the subways.
And let them die.
Well, they don't have to die. I mean, you could show the heroes saving them in a really convincing way.
Yeah, right.
But it's, like, it's to me, it's, like, go watch Ghostbusters, and that's why that movie works.
Yeah.
Is because it's like a movie that is grounded in reality, and even though it gets ever more fantastic to the point where there's a Marshmallow Man the size of the Empire State Building, the reality is, like, that much in proportion with that insanity where you're just seeing, like, thousands of people run in terror.
Right.
So that, to me, has been missing. Like, it's almost like these movies are sanitized by not showing that stuff.
Not almost. They are.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
All right, let's move along.
Okay, let's move along. I mean, you know, there's not much to talk about. Proteus is on his mission to find his dad. He's confused. He doesn't know what's going on. He's learning about... He doesn't know what, like, being a father and son is. He just, like, a vague sense of it.
Yeah.
Professor X is trying to contact him telepathically. There's actually one cool scene where Proteus is watching television in some apartment building. And Professor X is trying to contact him, and so Proteus sees Professor X on the TV because that's how he's projecting his telepathy and the way he's warping reality.
Mm.
And he reaches through this television and yells at Professor X. And Professor X is on the Blackbird at this moment, and Professor X like is thrown back. He's almost having a heart attack because this is so insane.
Yeah, because Proteus like comes through that television screen and like into the Blackbird.
It's
for
like
a second.
It's like he's crossing all these dimensions of like. Thought, consciousness, and reality, you know?
Awesome.
Yeah, his power is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
So,
he shouldn't be anybody's therapist either.
Yeah.
Let it be noted.
Yeah. There's another scene where Rogue is, like, tackling Proteus, and she seemingly absorbs his power for a second and mm-hmm. causes the ground to rumble. But it's weird because it looks like she has all her clothes on when she's touching him.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's
going on. She has her gloves on and everything.
Yeah.
Is it showing just like that's how powerful he is?
I don't know.
Like gets absorbed even with her gloves on.
But he didn't seem to be weakened by her, which he technically should have been. He's a mutant, you know? I think like...
Huh.
So I don't know. That's a little inconsistency there, but no big deal. I just thought that stuck out to me. Like I said, I do like how Proteus can, like, he rises the grass out of the ground and rides it like a surfboard.
Yeah, it's cool.
That's pretty crazy. Then Professor X learns from Moira that Kevin's her son. He didn't know. And he feels betrayed for a second, but then has a very mature reaction.
Yeah.
He says, like, such a burden to bear alone. You know, he felt bad for her.
Right.
Because of all these years he's been harboring romantic disappointment with her.
Right.
Because she broke up with him, left him for another man. And
it's like he's still in love with her.
He has feelings for her.
He has feelings for her, even though he's in love with Lalandra.
But now he knows. Yeah. But now he knows.
This is his other
bond,
one
deeper
true
than love.
Love,
right? Yeah. But now he knows that like she had a real reason and why she dedicated herself to mutant like science.
Right.
And you know he said like it's a terrible burden for you, and they kind of have a nice little like emotional connection there. I thought that was a very mature moment. I really liked it. I liked seeing that.
Well, it also explains a lot about Moira and her character and why we keep seeing her.
Yeah.
Why she's so sympathetic.
She's a
to
great
cause.
I love her as an auxiliary X-Men character.
Yeah, she's good.
I really enjoyed her. I liked Rose Byrne's portrayal of her in the X-Men movies.
Yeah, me too.
I just like Rose Byrne, you know. Like,
yeah.
So she wasn't well served in X-Men Apocalypse, but whatever.
Yeah. I saw her in real life one time.
Really? Where?
Yeah. At like a yoga studio.
Wow.
I saw her.
You did yoga with her?
Yeah.
Whoa. That's sexy. You and Rose Byrne. I wish I was there.
It wasn't like a fancy celebrity yoga studio or anything. Just
that's
there
cool.
She was.
Did you talk to her?
No.
Really? You just totally ignored her?
Yeah.
You're too cool for school.
I don't know. Who wants
was
that
were
in
there,
a yoga
were there
class
people bothering
or...
her?
No. It was like a small class.
So how are you
like
sure it was her?
Eight people.
No one else acknowledged
her. I looked at her face.
All right, fair enough. And like you mentioned, there's a cool scene where Proteus is fighting the X-Men, and he has like four mini rogues attack Rogue. Which just shows how demented and insane his powers are and how messed up, you know, he is. And it also shows you, like, an X-Men movie done right, like, Proteus as the villain in a movie would be amazing, and the things it could do, it's like, your imagination's the limit, you know?
Yeah.
It just speaks to, like, why I think X-Men, like, they still haven't really, they haven't gone to places they could have with these X-Men movies, and hopefully Disney can really step it up a notch.
Mm.
Well, we'll see in the next Fox X-Men movie with the Dark Phoenix. I don't know. I don't have high hopes for that, but you never know. And then, here's the scene ripped directly from the comics. Proteus attacks Wolverine. He kind of, like, tears him in half, like, in, like, four ways, and then melts him in a puddle. That's pretty much taken exactly from the comics, especially the scene afterwards where Wolverine's, like, put back together, and he's crying. He's, like, so emotionally broken up that the person you would never think would cry cries because he's like that mentally destroyed.
Yeah.
So now, famously from the comics, Cyclops is at this battle and he is not pleased at the sight of Wolverine crying.
Mm-hmm.
And he, it's like, it's not like a woke time in the mid 70s. So he starts like slapping and punching Wolverine around, like goes him into a fight. And it's just like, that's how he gets Wolverine back to normal, by pissing him off.
Yeah.
Which actually is kind of clever. Like, that kind of fits with the Wolverine character, but it's, like, he did have a very traumatic experience, and Cyclops' solution is to just, like, piss him off.
Well, do you think it's insensitive, or do you think it's, like, Cyclops effective. Knows him really well, and well, he chooses that that's what, as a conscious...
That's what Cyclops' argument is. I don't know. It feels insensitive to me, but who knows? It's very bizarre.
Well, you're a more sensitive man than Wolverine.
Yeah, I guess. Well, I thought I was as sensitive as Cyclops. You know, I have related to him the most. I guess mainly because of the glasses. But
glasses don't make you sensitive.
Right. So the episode ends. The X-Men are defeated, and Proteus is off to still find his dad. Oh, and along the way, Moira contacts the father, and he wants nothing to do with the son, kind of. He says, well, I'm running for election for...
Right, like, I can't deal with this right now.
He says, like, maybe after the election I'll talk to him, but, yeah. You know, that's not going to work out.
Poor Proteus.
Yeah, it's pretty tragic. And like I said, it's, like, a great episode because of the themes of, like, really dangerous mutants that... It's like, what would you do with them in real life? It's kind of... In the comics, they just have to straight up kill him. And Moira actually is going to kill him at one point herself. She's got, she's going to shoot him with a sniper rifle. Mm. And somebody stops her. I forget if it's, like, Banshee or Nightcrawler or something. Like, knocks the gun out of her hand.
Wow.
And she's like, you ruined my shot. She's, like, legitimately angry. Mm. And she just gives zero fucks. Like, even though that's her son, she's just kind of...
She recognizes that he's the most dangerous being.
Yeah, yeah. It's like if Hitler's mom was alive and was like on a mission to kill her own son.
I mean, I guess, but Proteus not isn't like Hitler. Like, that's a bad genocidal.
Comparison. Yeah, no, that's a bad comparison. I don't know. I was just thinking of like some stupid science fiction premise where Hitler's mom is kidnapped as like a 25-year-old woman, and then they give her extensive ninja training. It's like only you could stop your son in 20 years in the future in 1943, and you see her in like a black like cat suit, you know, like flipping off. Buildings in Berlin, and she's got the shot. That's what that comic reminded me of. I have no idea.
I would read that comic book.
That's really right. Yeah, that's yeah. Right. That's insane. Yeah, it's totally insane. Right. There's something to that. Anyway, I mean, that's all I got for this episode. Any more thoughts on Proteus, Legion, X-Men costume colors? What you got, Soans?
Enough is enough. It's pizza time.
Okay, well, before we get pizza, let's just say join the X-Men Tast Facebook podcast group. Wait, what is it again? X-Men Tast Podcast. Search that out on Facebook. Join the group.
You said it right.
I said it right. Okay, yeah. Good. All right. I'm getting too confused now the more episodes we do. Follow me on Twitter at Willie Simpson. Also, rate us 5 stars on iTunes.
Please.
Please, if you don't mind. And continue being great fans, great people. We love you guys and girls. There's going to be more fun for season 4. Come back next week and we'll do Proteus Part 2. Why are you laughing at me? Why is that so funny?
I don't know. We will do Proteus Part 2.
Yeah, you can count on that. Okay. Any last words about anything, Sonia?
Nope, that's it.
Okay, good night, everybody.
Goodbye.